Chapter 37, Jack and Jill. Until autism first appeared in epidemic form in the 1930s, mental illness was an equal opportunity offender. Besides children, nearly anyone, it seemed, could and was struck down with progressive neurological decline. The dementia of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's were more rare, if only because most didn't make it into old age. As a result, the feeble-minded and, quote, lunatics of mental institutions and asylums were younger than the modern reader may be accustomed. Architectural plans for asylums were perfectly symmetrical, and in an attempt to prevent unwanted births, featured clear delineations between their male and female halves. Photographs of the inhabitants of these facilities present affected men and women similarly, and offer a clear testament to the horrors of the mentally ill, treated with medicines likely to have caused their suffering in the first place. During the day, the men would toil in the gardens located on acres of pasture that surrounded their institution, their labors part of a genuine effort to teach them skills which might grant them employment and some degree of self-sufficiency. The women would typically stay inside, working on their sewing, laundry, and other domestic duties, skills which nearby businesses and families could put to use through special agreements with their guardians. A cautious arrangement given their vulnerability to fictitious marriage proposals or outright assault. There is another distinguishing characteristic of the fairer sex, one that Connor and Asperger would not have been aware of. The female response to stress is wholly unlike that of males. In fact, the difference is so pronounced, it's considered to be the single most significant and most thoroughly documented distinction between genders besides pregnancy and childbirth. This was not realized until recently. Behavioral studies in the burgeoning fields of psychiatry often exclusively featured males as their test subjects. The potential for causing duress or emotional harm to female participants was frowned upon, and so early studies into the inner workings of the human mind were woefully inadequate. During the 1950s and 60s, when beliefs about gender roles began to lose their distinction, that began to change. As more science accumulated around the behavioral tendencies of both men and women, so too did evidence of their differences. And one of the most conspicuous distinctions involved the way in which females react to stress. While both genders appear to have a similar fight or flight response, differences emerge when the second phase occurs. If neither fighting nor fleeing appear capable of preventing bodily harm and immobilization or restraint occur, the male brain begins aggressive signaling for white blood cells to come to its aid. The female brain does not. When experiencing immobilization, restraint, and the threat of bodily harm, the female brain employs a different sequence of hormonal and biological events. Females will release oxytocin, a pain-relieving neurotransmitter called the cuddle hormone. The natural female response to this extreme form of stress is an increase in social bonding, sometimes referred to as tend and befriend, even to the point where women may attempt to develop a tentative friendship with their attacker. While this may seem like a futile response to physical attack, for a female who's being assaulted by someone twice her size and four times her strength, it may offer a higher chance of survival than a violent response. For decades, it was assumed that differences in testosterone or estrogen played a part in the male prevalence of autism. Estrogen, it was thought, might protect the brain from harm. Other research suggests that exposure to male hormones early on in life affects genes that may predispose someone to developing autism. These hypotheses may have some merit, but a quick survey of the prevalence of the two steroid hormones weakens these two hypotheses. Just before and after birth, there is a brief spike in estrogen in females and testosterone in males, thought to stimulate gender differentiation. Afterwards, these two hormones essentially flatline at zero until a decade later when they elevate as children begin puberty. During the period of 6 months to 10 years old, the amount of estrogen and testosterone produced by girls and boys is nearly zero. While the amounts are small, the differentiation between them is even less, a minuscule distinction for which the creation of a 4-to-1 ratio of boys to girls with autism seems unlikely. It is unknown if this difference in stress response exists in babies, but given the pronounced gender disparity between males and females and the lack of hormonal differentiation at that age, it would appear something other than the direct effects of estrogen and testosterone are playing a role. This discrepancy may serve a crucial role in understanding the underlying dysfunction of autism, a valuable clue in unlocking a mystery which has thus far felt impenetrable. Other neurological phenomena display a gender prevalence. It's not just autism. Multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, and epilepsy feature a more uniform distribution. With multiple sclerosis, females face an increased risk in onset of the disease, but males typically fare worse. Parkinson's disease is a neurodegenerative disorder that affects the substantia nigra, a specific location in the brain used in the production of dopamine. Parkinson's also displays a distinct male prevalence. Over twice as many men as women develop this illness. With any individual, the onset will vary, but from afar, a pattern begins to come into focus. Neurological illnesses, which do not affect men more than women, can take place anywhere within the brain. Neurological illnesses which do affect men more often originate from a very specific place, the brainstem, the epicenter of the human nervous system, and the very location from which the immune system signals for help during times of stress.